Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Israel once again has been accused of being an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian lands. Human rights groups say that Israel has created a system over all the territory in which Jews have full rights. Palestinians are divided into tiers with different levels of rights, but always below those of the Jews. Now, Tel Aviv has effective control over the Gaza Strip, which it has blockaded since 2006. In the West Bank, Palestinians live in disconnected enclaves under rigid military rule and devoid of political rights and security. They're also facing the dangers and risks of living under occupation. Stay for a debate on the issue.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered the advancement of a plan to build over 800 more settler units in the occupied West Bank. Netanyahu's office says the units will be constructed in several settlement complexes. It, however, failed to determine a starting date for the project. The announcement comes in defiance of international law, which considers all Israeli settlements on occupied land as illegal. Even multiple United Nations Security Council resolutions have failed to deter Tel Aviv from its expansionist agenda. Many Palestinians say Netanyahu is using U.S. President Donald Trump's remaining days in office to push ahead with his settlement ambitions.
Netanyahu and his regime are racing against time. They are using the time when U.S. President Donald Trump was in a presidency to approve more settlement projects and settlement units. And this is what happens today. Before the inauguration of the new American administration, Netanyahu has approved the building.
Palestinians have for decades expressed their anger and concern over the seizure of their lands and turning them into settler units. They have been demanding the international community to put a halt to Israel's settlement plans. In a latest push, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shtayyeh said the international community should oblige the Israeli occupying regime to stop its colonial projects in Palestine. The premier said the continued settlement activities show Israel's disregard for international laws and statutes. However, many see the Israeli settlement expansion in a much broader context. On Monday, an Israeli-based rights advocacy NGO accused Tel Aviv of being an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy on the occupied land. Betzalem said Israel has created a system in all occupied territories where Jewish people have full rights. The group that documents human rights violations in the Israeli-occupied territories says Palestinians in the West Bank live in disconnected enclaves under rigid military rule and without political rights.
You know, there's an international convention on the crime of apartheid and racial discrimination, which specifically says that people living in the same country should not be subjected to two different sets of laws. And that's how it defines apartheid.
But what really gives the Israeli regime the courage to pursue the policy of oppression against Palestinians? Many say Washington's unconditional support for the Israeli regime is to blame. Donald Trump has been a staunch supporter of Netanyahu's settlement policy in the occupied territories. But given Israel's settlement expansions and its pursuance of the so-called Jewish supremacy agenda, the question arises whether the new U.S. administration will be any different to its predecessor in stopping Tel Aviv's apartheid policies, or will it turn a blind eye to them as it has been doing in the past 7 decades.
Let's get it started. Joining me will be human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and award-winning Palestinian journalist Daoud Kattab from Amman. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Daniel. Drawing a comparison between apartheid in South Africa and Israel, observers argue that the Israeli apartheid in occupied Palestine is more militaristic and more brutal, while in the South Africa, the blacks were never blockaded or killed, as Tel Aviv is doing in the case of the Palestinians. Do you agree?
I do. And so does, by the way, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who won the Nobel Prize. Of course, he's from South Africa. He's made that observation. In fact, I think even to call it apartheid is to understate the situation. I've been saying for a while that really this is a process of genocide. You know, look at what's happening with the coronavirus immunizations. Israel's giving it to Jews there, but not giving it to Palestinians. I mean, that's incredible. They're the occupying force. They have to make sure under international law, under international humanitarian law, that people get proper, you know, water, food, medical attention, which would include these immunizations. Israel's not only refusing to guarantee these things, they're preventing people in Palestine from getting these things, dumping sewage into farmland, into fresh water. This is an act of genocide.
Right. Now, turning to Aman Daoud, how do you describe the lives of millions of Palestinians living under the ongoing Israeli occupation?
Well, it's clearly a different rule for Israelis. I think the reason the apartheid is listed as a war crime. With the South African struggle against apartheid, the international community agreed to list apartheid as a war crime according to international humanitarian law. And so that's why you see a lot of usage of the term, and that's why you see the Israelis rejecting the term, because the moment that they accept the existence of apartheid, they basically concede that they are committing an ongoing war crime, because the settlements and the settlers are not supposed to be moved to occupied areas. The fact that you have settlers who are Israeli citizens who live under Israeli civilian law, living side by side with Palestinians who have no political rights and are under military law, you have a two-system situation. And so that's what apartheid is all about.
Daniel, apparently it's only Europe that's still denying the Israeli practice of this apartheid system in spite of overwhelming evidence of that effect. What's behind the Europeans' denial of this fact?
Well, because if they admitted it, they would be required to do something about it. You know, I mean, the irony, of course, is that Europe and the U.S., Canada always talk about the need to engage in humanitarian intervention in other countries to guarantee human rights and humanitarian law. If they admitted how bad the situation was for Palestine, they would have to act under their own arguments, you know? If any place in the world calls for some sort of humanitarian intervention, it would be in Palestine to protect them from Israel. And so, you know, you see the West downplaying how brutally the Palestinians are being treated for that reason.
Daoud, as Daniel mentioned, the Europeans need to do something about it if they admit the plight of the Palestinians. And they are doing something about it. You know what they're doing? They're selling weapons to Israel. They're doing trade. They have commercial ties. They're even having, cultural, educational ties with the occupied regime that has no regard for international law and human rights. How could they justify this?
Well, you have to ask them, but they are trying to say, what we're trying to ask them, since they claim that they support the solution, that's their kind of natural kind of default statement. We support the two-state solution. Well, a two-state solution means Palestine and Israel. Israel exists and it's a member of this land. If you do believe in a two-state solution, why don't you recognize the state of Palestine? And then the state of Palestine and will conduct negotiations with Israel on how to deal and how to manage the relationship between these two countries. But they refuse to do that. Only Sweden recognizes the state of Palestine. And when you ask the rest of the countries, you know, your own parliament passed a resolution recognizing the state of Palestine. When will you, the executive branch, recognize the state of Palestine? They say, well, we want to do it as a whole. We want to kind of have a power behind the declaration. So when we recognize it, it will actually produce some results. And they've been saying that for the last 20 years. Nothing happened. So they've not really tapped in on this idea of mass recognition, but at the same time, they're holding back in accepting what they're saying that they support, the two-state solution. Now, many Palestinians have stopped agreeing to the two-state solution, seeing what is happening and that it must be more efficient for equal rights in a single state than continue to go for a two-state solution. But the two-state solution has become a default, an easy statement that everybody can say. And even the Israelis say, we don't mind having something that Palestinians call a Palestinian state, but it will still have Israeli control on the borders, on the air, on the sea, on the water. But if you want to have a state, call it whatever you want. So what we want is a sovereign state that has control of its land and borders, and it's based on the 67 borders. That's what Palestinians want. And otherwise, Europe, as you said, is keeping up to its own core standards.
Now, Daniel, as you know, the world is grappling with this deadly pandemic. Even in this situation, Tel Aviv does not abide by the international conventions that oblige the regime as an occupying power to come up and provide residents of those areas it has usurped with badly needed pharmaceuticals and medical care. Sky's the limit when it comes to impunity for Tel Aviv, isn't it?
Yes, of course. Again, Israel is now engaged in a robust immunization program for Israelis, and they are not administering immunizations to Palestinians. Again, the long-time embargo against Palestine and other actions that have been done to destroy Palestinian water supplies, these are all contributing to COVID, the COVID spread in Palestine. And again, it's by design. The Israelis want to destroy the Palestinian people. I'm convinced of that. And again, that's why I tend to call this a genocide, not just apartheid.
I see. Now, Daoud, let's look at it from a different aspect. How far has Trump's all-out support emboldened Netanyahu and other Israeli officials to further expand the illegal settlements? You know, as you see, during the last days of Trump at the White House, they're even accelerating this process.
Yeah, well, Trump has done a few things since taking office. He moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem in defiance of international law. Defunded the UN refugee agency. He recognized the Golan Heights as Israeli territory, the annexation of the Golan Heights. And the worst part is that they declared a plan in which Israel is allowed to take one-third of the Palestinian territories, and in return they give Palestinians a few enclaves in the desert. And they're saying this is basically they dictated, they wanted to dictate a plan on Palestinians in which they have to agree to give up one-third of their land in addition to their capital, East Jerusalem, and that land. So, and still Israel will control the borders in which they still call it a Palestinian state, but Israel will control all the borders. It was a sham of what's called the U.S. Trump vision of Palestinians, call it the jokingly the deal of the century, but it basically has now failed as Trump in his elections. And I think Palestinians, like everybody else, are happy to see this man leave the political scene.
And Daniel, how do you look at this? I mean, the different administrations of the White House, they have always supported the Tel Aviv regime doing whatever they wanted to do against the Palestinians. But the support that President Trump gave to the Tel Aviv regime has been, many believe that has been all out par excellence. Do you agree?
Well, of course. I mean, the fact that the U.S. is now under Trump recognized Jerusalem as being, you know, the capital of Israel. This is a huge sea change. Again, the cutting off of the aid to the Palestinian refugees. This is a unique thing in U.S. history. And frankly, yeah, this attempt by Trump, and successful attempt to get various countries in the region, including the Gulf states, to essentially turn their back on the Palestinian people, all these things are, you know, an incremental move towards Israel and, again, towards the ultimate abandonment of the Palestinians.
Daoud, let's take a glance at the so-called Washington broker normalization deal signed by Tel Aviv recently in a number of Arab states. How big a role do those deals play in Israeli land grab policy and infringing on Palestinians' rights?
Well, let's dissect that. First of all, the four countries that have been involved in the normalization issue have had different levels of so-called normalization. The Sudanese have yet to approve the idea because their parliament has to meet and then they would approve it. The Moroccans have yet to also stipulate exactly what they plan to do, even though they've had some type of normal relations with Israel because of the Jewish Moroccans who live in Israel and who live in Morocco. So it has not been, of course, it was a stab against the Palestinians because the Arab countries committed that they would only normalize relationship with Israel once Israel withdrew from the occupied territory and agreed to a just solution of the refugees. So it weakened the Palestinian negotiating position. I don't think it has much to do. The Emirates have only like a million Emiratis, and Bahrain is like 800,000 people living in it. So they're two really tiny countries. I mean, they have a lot of money, but they're not really that big. Sudan is a big country, and so is Morocco. So those would be much more important. And in a way, that's why they have not come to the pressure, even though each one of them had a deal with the Americans. The Sudanese wanted to be lifted from the terror list, and the Moroccans wanted somebody to recognize their sovereignty over the Western Sahara. So, in the end, it is a setback, but it's not a big setback because, on the bottom line, Palestinians live in the occupied territories. They're there. They're not going anywhere. And sooner or later, Israel has to figure out a way to deal. You marry us or divorce us. You either give Palestinians equal rights or you let Palestinians have their own state. You either share the power or you share the country. You cannot have it both ways. And what is happening now is apartheid. It's having it both ways. Israel wants to control the land, and it doesn't want equal rights to the people, and that's why we're having this two-tier legal system. And what is interesting about Beit Salem's report today is that an Israeli major, mainstream Israeli human rights organization is saying, we're no longer going to separate between Israel's activities in Israel and activities in occupied territories because it's a one country. Basically, it's one leadership that's deciding this apartheid system, and it has to stop. And so I tip my hands to Beit Salem. It took them 50 years to come up with this decision, but it's good that they have come up with that. And I hope more and more Israelis understand what their government is doing.
Hopefully. Now, Daniel, Palestinians have been deprived of all their rights in the past several decades, as you know. Their lands and homes are stolen, and they're still being stolen and razed to the ground. They're denied an army to defend themselves. They're deprived of the free movement on their own land. The refugees are not allowed to go back home. They have no viable government. Some Arab states have betrayed them. So what choice and options do they have to see an end to this Israeli occupation and an end to their plight?
Well, I don't know, to be honest. I think they are running out of options, not because of anything they've done, but because of Israel and because the world community, again, has largely abandoned them, as you say. I think what has to happen is for people in the United States and in Europe to show solidarity with the Palestinian people, to demand that Palestine be recognized, to demand the Palestinians be given their right. That is the only thing that can be done to help Palestine, is that the people of the West have to stand up for the Palestinian people.
Daoud, what do you think? What choice do the Palestinians have?
Well, I think they do have a number of things. Some of it is self-inflicted wounds of differences and disunity. So we're hoping that there will be elections on May 22nd in the West Bank in Gaza, and we can start rebuilding our own national unity. That's the number one. We need to have a unified Palestinian position. Secondly, we need to really work with the Palestinian diaspora and with the people of solidarity, like Daniel and others, to really enact the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. That has to really be the nonviolent tool that we have to use to force Israel to come to terms with the fact that it cannot live and control 5 million people against their will and deny the refugees the right to return. That has to change. And I think a boycott, divestment, and sanctions have to be used as a weapon, just like the South Africans used, to really get the world to put pressure on Israel to change its policy.
All right, on that note, we come to the end of this debate show. Let me thank our guests. We had human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and also award-winning Palestinian journalist Dawood Kattab, who joined us from Amman, Jordan, with their comments and contribution. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
Islam. The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
فرمودن و من کان یحب ان یعلم منزلته عند الله.
One day the Holy Prophet of Islam came to his companions and stated, if someone wants to find his true position by Allah and whether he has a high rank in the eyes of Allah or not, he or she must look first inside his or her heart to find Allah in it. Does Allah have a place in my heart, or my personal desires replaced Allah in it? Do I consider myself superior to Allah, or Allah is the most high in my eyes? If someone is given the chance of preferring Allah to everything in any moment of his life, then truly he has a high position in the eyes of Allah too. May Allah bless the soul of the late Ayatollah Araki. Once in a session, I heard him talking about the late Ayatollah Muhammad Taghi Khansari and calling him among the Bawabin. We asked Ayatollah Araki the meaning of this term, that is Bawabin, used for Ayatollah Khansari. Ayatollah Araki answered, it means that he was always sitting at the door of his heart, not letting anyone inside it except Allah. And this was the main reason for Ayatollah Araki to love Ayatollah Khansari very much. Now, such people
who do not let anyone inside their heart and soul except Allah will for sure have high position by Allah too. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Kalab Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Kalab Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters.
Leaders of Russia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan set for talks in the Russian capital Moscow to discuss the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh. The negotiations lasted about 4 hours, during which Russian President Vladimir Putin called for resolving issues connected with the peacekeeping operation, as well as clarification of demarcation lines, humanitarian problems, and protection of cultural heritage sites.
Today we can note with satisfaction that trilateral agreements are applied in practice. We believe that it creates necessary conditions for a full-fledged settlement of the old conflict on the just basis in the interests of both Azeri and Armenian nations.
Putin thanked Aliyev and Pashinyan for the fact that they positively perceived the active mediation actions of Russia aimed at stopping the bloodshed and stabilizing the situation. After 6 weeks of deadly fighting in and around Karabakh in September, Yerevan and Baku eventually agreed on November 9th to end hostilities under a Moscow broker deal that secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan in Karabakh and 7 surrounding districts. The situation seems calm, with the exchange of prisoners and bodies of the dead carried out smoothly.
I believe that the key to success is to put an end to the presence of non-regional players such as France and the US. experience shows that integration of regional players lead to great achievements. As we saw in the case of Syria, regional conflicts are resolved only when regional players sit for talks.
Following the trilateral talks in the Kremlin, the parties signed a joint statement on the development of Nagorno-Karabakh. To this end, it was decided that a plan be presented in the near future by the deputy prime ministers of Russia, Azerbaijan and Armenia.
2 months have passed since the ceasefire was signed. Our presence here shows that we are determined to fulfill the commitments made in September and November.
Unfortunately, today we couldn't resolve the issue of war prisoners. This is the most sensitive and painful issue. We agreed to continue our cooperation in this area. We believe that the 8th paragraph of our joint statement has not yet been fully implemented. I hope we could make a concrete decision as soon as possible.
As part of the ceasefire, nearly 2,000 Russian peacekeepers have stationed along the Lachin Corridor in Azerbaijan, a 60 kilometers long route that links Khankendi to Armenia.
According to the Russian Ministry of Defense, by January 10th, over 48,000 refugees from Armenia returned to the region. The Russian department conducts round-the-clock monitoring of the situation and the ceasefire in the region. In addition, damming work continues. Марина Картунова, Москва.
Less than 2 weeks, Democrat Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. But unlike the country's much-touted slogan of peaceful transition of power, nothing within the country seems peaceful. The capital, Washington, D.C., saw unprecedented fatal riots on the Capitol building. It all began after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump attacked Congress during its meeting to certify Biden's win in the November election. Officials have blamed Trump for inciting the violence as he kept refusing for months to concede defeat. They say U.S. democracy is in danger. President Trump now faces threats of impeachment just days before his tenure comes to an end. House Democrats have already drafted articles of impeachment against Trump over the Wednesday insurrection. The draft was prepared after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Trump to resign immediately. She also urged the invocation of the 25th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The amendment calls for the removal of a president who is unable to discharge his official duties. Trump has been shunned by many members of his own Republican Party as well. President-elect Biden has also called him one of the most incompetent presidents in U.S. history. Outside the country, world leaders, including Washington's allies, have criticized Trump supporters' attack on Capitol Hill.
What we witnessed was an assault on democracy by violent rioters incited by the current president and other politicians. Violence has no place in our societies, and extremists will not succeed in overruling the will of the people.
Britain has reacted too.
What President Trump has been saying about that has been completely wrong, and I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol.
France criticized the Capitol riot, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel blamed Trump for sharing the blame. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro called the violence a reflection of what Washington has been using to do with other countries.
What we see that Donald Trump did, without a doubt, is what they are used to doing with the countries of the world. These same poor rural whites are the ones one sees dressed up as Superman invading Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Panama, and Grenada.
The U.S. has always regarded itself as the bastion of democracy in the world. Now, the recent chaotic scenes are seen as undeniable proof of the fragility of democracy there, while they also mark an extraordinary moment in the American history.
The serial killings of Iranian scientists must stop. This comment was made by families of the 5 slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now the households of the victims have filed the lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
Yesterday, we presented the case to Iran's Shahid Beheshti Court for International Affairs. Of course, the case will demand that those culpable in the killing of the nuclear scientists face justice. Such a case is not unprecedented, since the U.S. has for several times taken a similar path against our government and froze our government's foreign assets.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but it is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country, so we filed a lawsuit against the U.S. as the major supporter of Israel's criminal agenda. If finalized, the case will lead to the seizure of $100 million of U.S. assets in foreign banks.
The legal action comes over a month after the assassination of top Iranian nuclear figure Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which, as in the previous incidents, Iran blames on Israel. Israel has a history of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. Fakhrizadeh is the fifth victim. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the killings, its footsteps can be tracked. In video recorded in 2018, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Coupled with the EU's lack of commitment to the 2015 nuclear deal, the assassination of Fakhrizadeh made Iran change its policy with regards to its nuclear program. In response, the Islamic Republic officially announced that it resumed enriching uranium at 20% purity, markedly distancing from the 3.67% cap set by the nuclear deal. The legal team here says the lawsuit against the U.S. pursues a single goal: to break the chain of its unlawful targeting of its key scientists. However, while the five slain scientists are viewed as the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry, officials say the sector is up and running. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The democratically controlled U.S. House of Representatives is expected to consider launching an impeachment process against the U.S. president on Wednesday. The Democratic lawmakers say they will move ahead with the measure if Vice President Mike Pence refuses to invoke the 25th Amendment, an article that would immediately unseat the president if he is deemed unfit for office.
That's going to be very difficult to achieve, one, because I don't think Vice President Pence is inclined to do so. Probably viewing it as political suicide for his future in case he wants to run for president in the future. So I don't think that one's likely. In the context of impeachment, it is a political process. And right now, I think the will is there by the Democratic Party, and it seems like even some Republicans may be interested.
So far, we've seen an unwillingness of Pence in particular to move forward with the 25th Amendment, and Trump, of course, is not taking responsibility or taking it upon himself to resign, as he has been called upon to do. So I'm not surprised that impeachment is likely to be the result.
Democrats and a few Republican lawmakers are calling for Trump's removal from office, citing his conduct and rhetoric. Experts say the lack of bipartisan balance in the calls, however, can put U.S. national security at risk.
I think there's certainly a risk of something atrocious happening. I hope, hearing that Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, has been in contact with Pentagon officials, there may be some checks, but it does reveal somewhat of a danger in our process in terms of how powerful the executive is, and maybe we should think about that in future.
The longer he remains in office, he still has access to all kinds of classified information and security codes. He has been isolating himself, which elevates the level of uncertainty about his actions in the coming days and weeks. I think there's definitely reason to be concerned about our overall security.
Last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi underlined the urgency to remove Trump by speaking with Pentagon officials about safeguards of the president's access to the nuclear codes in the last days of his presidency. To make matters worse for Trump, the U.S. Department of Justice hasn't ruled out filing charges of insurrection, sedition, and attempted coup against him. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Corvello.
Coronavirus infections among the general population are still rising in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The number of infections has risen to over 45,000, mostly since August of last year. Hospitals in Gaza continue to run low on intensive care units and ventilators, as well as medicines and equipment. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on Gaza's health sector.
The international community must exert real pressure on Israel to end its illegal blockade of Gaza and allow local authorities to combat the coronavirus pandemic. The international community must also provide badly needed medical aid to the overwhelmed health sector in Gaza, which is already in a bad shape and struggling to fight the coronavirus.
The pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip, threatening the socio-economic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
People here are terrified by the rapid spread of coronavirus infections. Our hospital lack of vital equipment and medicines, and our health system has been battered by the Israel blockade.
The economy has been hit hard by the pandemic, and people are afraid and hardly have any income. Nowadays, it is very hard to maintain a business because of the tight restrictions.
Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the spread of COVID-19. They currently impose lockdowns from 8 p.m. until 7 a.m. and a complete curfew on Fridays and Saturdays.
The emergency measures, including lockdowns, will continue in order to fight the spread of the virus. We call on everyone to stay at home during the lockdowns and abide by safety measures.
Human rights groups have repeatedly warned of the catastrophic implications of coronavirus spread in the Gaza Strip.
Experts say Israel's inhumane practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to fight the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
With just over a week before the departure of Donald Trump from the White House, a public emergency has been declared in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. That after an unprecedented chaos and the violent storming of the Capitol building by Trump supporters in their efforts to force Congress to overturn the presidential election results. U.S. officials refer to these incidents as days of infamy, accusing Trump of directly inciting the mob to what they call shameful assaults on the American democracy. President-elect Joe Biden called Trump the most incompetent president in the history of the United States.
I've been saying for now well over a year, he is not fit to serve. He is not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump a very dangerous person, saying his removal is an emergency of the highest magnitude.
The president has committed an unspeakable assault on our nation and our people. If the vice president and cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Pelosi said she has instructed the House to move forward with an impeachment motion if Trump does not leave Oval Office voluntarily. According to U.S. media, Democratic representatives have already prepared a draft article of impeachment that accuses Trump of engaging in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting the Capitol Hill insurrection. He will be the first American president to be impeached twice by the House. Democrats are not alone in their bid. Some Republicans have also joined their rallying cries against Trump.
The president is unfit, and the president is unwell, and the president must now relinquish control of the executive branch voluntarily or involuntarily.
A recent joint Reuters-Ipsos opinion poll also shows 57% of Americans are in favor of Trump's immediate removal from office. 7 out of 10 of those who had voted for Trump in the November election also decried the recent storming of the Capitol building. Surprisingly, defiant Trump later denounced the violent protests and pledged for a peaceful transition of power. However, hours later, he once again took to his Twitter, saying he would not attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. Twitter has now permanently suspended his account, saying several of Trump's posts violate the platform's policy against the glorification of violence. Trump says Twitter is banning free speech. With a traditional departure of a sitting president from Washington now off the table, security concerns are growing for Biden's inauguration. Photos and videos emerging from the Capitol seat show the extent of violence American rioters and white supremacists are capable of. Deaths and vandalism at the Capitol show the United States' much-touted slogan of democracy can be easily endangered by its very own citizens.
The parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen's Marib have halted the process of 10 prisoner swap deals that would release more than 300 prisoners from both sides. The exchange was a part of an agreement reached recently between the warring local parties. An official of the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs blames the mercenaries for the halt.
When tribal mediators are involved in the release of the prisoners, the mercenaries stop them. This is also true about these exchanges that include more than 300 prisoners. The mercenaries are not one party, but rather there are several parties. And whenever we agree with one party, the other side fails it.
This comes while the Yemeni army has made significant achievements in advancing towards the city of Marib to liberate it. Halting the prisoner swap will put more pressure on the Yemeni army to stop the advance of coalition forces on the ground.
The coalition forces play several cards to stop the army's advance toward Marib in order to win a battle that will liberate the city. Halting the prisoner exchange is one of those. This is another effort by Saudi-led coalition to pressure the Yemeni army.
The prisoners' committee was able to liberate hundreds of prisoners during 2020 through local negotiations without any international mediation. However, the Saudi-led coalition seeks to stop the humanitarian process.
Thousands of Yemenis are still in prisons waiting for the United Nations to stop the delays in the release and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to commit to its obligation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iranian experts and ophthalmologists have gathered in Tehran to unveil a new method in eye surgery which enables the doctors to cure problems in their offices without anesthesia and bleeding. Panisplexer offers an alternative to invasive surgical procedures, reducing recovery time and any complications that can arise before and after surgery. It is an innovative development in eye treatments by utilizing the fourth state of matter, or plasma.
This new technique that uses plasma is being practiced for the first time. Within the past 20 years, plasma has been used in dentistry, treatment of cancer, and scar healing. Since some years ago, we decided to use it in ophthalmology to make sure it is safe. Almost 15 eye diseases can be cured at the doctor's office without going to the surgery room.
This is an international event to unveil a low-cost method for eye disorder treatments. It is a pain-free Iranian method called PANIS, or plasma-assisted non-invasive surgery. This is a result of 5 years of collaboration between two Iranian companies and an Italian counterpart.
This method has been practiced in many countries, but Iranian scientists have now turned it to a method to decrease treatment costs, as it does not need surgery rooms and hospital beds.
Such outstanding achievements show that the sanctions by the West have not been able to slow down Iran's advancement, proving that the Islamic Republic is moving forward on the right track. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
For refugees in reception camps in Greece, it has been a year of fires, double displacement, and now COVID-19. With rolling lockdowns enforced since March, along with restrictions that have only served to make unbearable living conditions even worse. In response to this, independent groups have sprung up and are trying to make a difference. Yellow Days is one of them, empowering forced migrants and changing the narrative surrounding their circumstances lies at the heart of everything they do. The friendships forged during Yellow Days festivals have lasted, and although COVID-19 prevented them from getting together in 2020, the team is still busy making magic happen online.
We have this, distortion and idea of feeling that the refugee community has
poor people, they're waiting to be helped, they're just depressed and waiting for answers, and it's far from the reality that I have experienced, especially with all my forced migrant friends. They're people that are active, they're people with loads of skill, power and talent, and all that we do at the Yellow Days is bring all those people together.
Yellow Days is run by a core group of 8 women, which members say is one of its most important aspects. One of the primary goals of groups like this is creating a model for a more sustainable future, not only for forced migrants and minorities, but the entire human race.
Because our system of capitalism and white supremacy, what we definitely know is that we can't rely on governments to help, and the media propaganda machine is so well-financed and consistent that we are lacking not just political will but also human will. And I think this isn't really a time this year with COVID and 2020, this has also been a time for people to start waking up to their own power.
The International Rescue Committee says depression, post-traumatic stress disorder and self-harm that are the byproducts of hopelessness and despair have spiked amid COVID-19 restrictions. With the majority of asylum applications on pause, there's no means of escape, and during COVID-19, self-isolating often means being locked in a shipping container with many others.
More than half of those surveyed said that COVID has caused them depression, worry, anxiety and loneliness.
Every year, tens of thousands of refugees reach Greek shores. The media has aided the dehumanization of asylum seekers by reducing them to just that, a statistic. But there are still those fighting for stories to be told and lives celebrated. Bianca Rahimi, London.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami dini wal-Arna ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to be talking about some of the Islamic laws hovering around marriage or marriage-related questions according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
You know, we know that sometimes travel or journeys are involved in everybody's life, and people travel, and some of the people have to travel abroad, or overseas. And if a man has to stay out of the country, and basically in this scenario, the husband does not have immediate access to his wife, right?
Yes.
So is it possible for the man, in fact, to, let's say, contract a kind of temporary marriage or marry to a woman temporarily? Muslim or non-Muslim? This is the first question. And the second one, which is quite related to that, is should it be actually with the permission of his wife?
These two questions are very much important and very, you see, of daily significance. Since you rightly mentioned that there are a lot of men on traveling abroad, they do not have access to their wives, so they want to they do not want to fall into a sin, and they want to take action for some sort of marriage.
Yes.
Yes, it is usually temporary marriage. Of course, we need to understand that a man does not need his wife's permission in order to get married to another woman. Okay, the marriage can be temporary or permanent. In either case, he does not need to obtain his wife's permission, his permanent wife's permission.
Yes.
But here we need to understand that it is very much important for the husband to respect his wife's emotions, his wife's feelings and sentiments.
Yes.
Probably some men have children back at home.
Yes.
And if the wife, the permanent wife, happens to understand or learn that her husband is having another wife.
Yes.
Her sentiment or emotion will be deeply hurt.
Exactly.
And
touched.
Therefore, both of them actually run the risk of losing their marital life.
Yes.
And also the children will suffer as a result of this kind of deteriorating relationship. The two sides will get more and more actually emotionally divorced and separated from each other.
Yes.
And their relationship will be hurt, and of course it will be very difficult to repair the relationship between the two, the husband and the wife. And therefore, Ayatollah Sistani says that it's better and it's highly recommended that the husband respect his wife's emotion
and observe piety in this case.
Yeah, observe piety and should try to abstain from getting married to another woman. Of course, if he gets married to another woman, the marriage is permissible. The marriage is